This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 4th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Rylan and welcome to The Recap, a selection of the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, I'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, as the never-ending saga gripping Greece continues to ripple throughout Europe, we'll hear about a series of rallies taking place across the nation.
Shall we continue with these proposals, as forwarded by the institutions, the Troika, or do we renegotiate and firmly remain within the euro? You can pick and choose.
Plus, Hungary begins offering cash incentives to attract young citizens back to the country.
There's been a survey recently that said 30% of them have college degrees, and that's 200,000 college graduates, which a country of 10 million people can ill afford to lose.
We'll also hear a highlight from this week's series focusing on the evolution of the television news anchor. Plus, a quick chat with Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé in Murano. All that and much more coming up right here on The Recap with me, Ben Rylan. Plenty ahead of us then, so let's get things started with a highlight from this week's series on The Globalist. We focused on the evolution of the television news anchor, from the early days when radio ruled supreme to the current flood of 24-hour news channels. In this highlight, however, we're tuning into the rather different news climate in Ukraine. Throughout the country's recent turbulent history, observers got used to a degree of propaganda coming from both sides of the divide. It gave one group of enterprising young journalists the hunger to launch a new venture designed to restore journalistic impartiality. Broadcasting in English, Russian and Ukrainian, Hromadsky International relies on donations to operate. Free from the influence of oligarchs, the news network has earned itself a reputation as one of the most trusted sources of insights and information from the heart of Ukraine. Maxim Eristavi was one of the founding anchors of Hromadsky. He tells us now about the unique challenges facing Ukrainian news anchors.
Hromadsky is a success story in a very unlikely place. It was created out of a necessity, you can say, as a refugee camp for many of those journalists who were fed up with rising censorship in Ukraine. And there was no choice for them where to practice journalism because the free speech places were so limited by that time. And it grew up of necessity to provide a truthful and balanced reporting for all those people who were seeking to find it and weren't able to find in Ukraine, where there is actually no free press was by that time. It was a mainly tightly controlled media market by oligarchs with their own agenda.
Ukraine's Minister of Information, Yuri Stets, has announced the creation of a new channel called Ukraine Tomorrow and a new so-called iArmy to combat Russian propaganda in an increasingly bitter information war between Moscow and Kyiv.
Actually, I joined Hromadsky when I got the same kind of frustration with the international coverage of the Ukrainian crisis and the revolution and the following war in eastern Ukraine. Because me and other people who created Hromadsky International saw this growing gap in Ukraine coverage, a bit of distorted focuses, a lot of generalizing, and we thought that we have to fill that gap and we have to satisfy those viewers and those people who are actually looking for true stories about what's really matters in the region. For example, humanitarian crisis in eastern Ukraine that still stays largely undercovered, or human rights violation, or weird perspective on human rights equality by the new government. And there are a lot of stories that unfortunately does not they do not fit the general narrative of global coverage that follows blood and sensations. And instead, we wanted to bring some light and give voice to those stories that really matter and people could relate to them emotionally and personally instead.
Personally, I cannot be part of a network funded by the Russian government that whitewashes the actions of Putin.
The purpose of Hromadske exactly do not fit in, because you cannot fit in what is happening in media landscape in Ukraine, because it's so depressing and so frustrating, because 99% of media outlets are controlled by oligarchs with their own agenda. And there is actually a recent polls in Ukraine after revolution shows that from 76 to 92% of population in different regions do not trust national media, because they know that when you try to watch evening news or try to read the newspaper, you always have this paranoia inside you going on, asking yourself what kind of agenda this particular media outlet has.
I wanted to discuss with you is just what is happening in Central Europe regarding the Ukraine crisis, because we know that there is a clear and unfortunately rising division.
I truly believe that a news anchor should follow journalism standards and to present stories in a golden standard of journalism by giving an opportunity and voice to as much sites as possible when it comes to the story. But at the same time, I think the landscape for news anchor, not only in Ukraine, but in the world, changes dramatically and very quickly, because before we would expect from news anchor being just a newsreader presenting automatically stories without having any input or impact. And I think that it changes dramatically. People want to see and want to feel some kind of emotional relation to the anchor. And I personally do not believe that you can be 100% objective by covering stories that are close to you. For example, I cover a lot of LGBT-related stories, but also as an openly gay journalist, I cannot possibly not disclosing my relations to those stories. And I think that it makes those stories even more stronger, because I know nuances, I can explain stuff that other journalists who do not have any personal relations to stories cannot do that. So I think this kind of area is still evolving, and the job of news anchor is evolving too, facing challenges of new digital media landscape. But something supposed to be and should stay classy is following golden journalism standards.
That was Ukrainian journalist Maxim Aristavi there, speaking to us from Kiev. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24 with me, Ben Rylan. Well, it's down to the wire in Greece. Sunday's referendum on the future of the country looks likely to show that views on the nation's direction are split almost straight down the middle. Mass rallies in favour of both the yes and the no camps are setting the scene all over the country's cities. So what happens next? Konstantin Buhaye is a writer and regular commentator on all things Greece and Europe. He spoke to Monocle's Tom Edwards on Friday's edition of The Briefing.
The choices are many because people interpret this referendum in completely different ways. The way the government presented it is a referendum on whether to accept the set of proposals put forward by the institutions as a plan for Greece to follow out of its debt. That was fair enough. Then the institutions jump in and said, well, the set of proposals weren't finalised, so you can't vote on them. Then they said, well, in fact, the set of proposals have been withdrawn, therefore you have nothing to vote on. So their referendum is useless. Then the institution said, well, in fact, no, you can go ahead with your referendum. This is the European Union institutions and the IMF. They said, you can go ahead with a referendum. However, this is a referendum about whether you want to stay in the euro, in which case you vote yes, or if you want to get out of the euro, in which case you vote no. That's what they said. The Greek government comes back and says, not at all. This is a referendum where the Greek people will decide, shall we continue with these proposals as forwarded by the institutions, the Troika, or do we renegotiate and firmly remain within the euro? You can pick and choose. And then you have Nobel Prize winning in economics saying, in fact, it should be a no and stay in the European Union. Then you have another giant of finance saying, in fact, it should be a yes because things are going to go pear-shaped. So the major experts have dropped to the same level as the street speculator as to what will actually happen.
Do you think then, Constantine, in terms of the political terms, when we look at, I don't know, the wider European project, not just the currency, which is a political thing in itself, but more broadly when we look at the whole of the EU project even?
Absolutely. No, you put your finger on it. The Brits are following this very closely because of Brexit. Now, I have it from apparently sources close to the government, to Prime Minister David Cameron, that the British government line on this is, what's bad for Greece is good for Europe. Bad for Greece, good for Britain. Because, so the source said, if Greece is dropped out of the euro, it will stabilise, that's the British view, they will stabilise the European economic zone, and therefore Britain, it'll be easier for Britain, A, to do business, B, to negotiate its own referendum points where it wishes to make certain adjustments. It's absolutely key, both for Britain and for the European Union project.
Whatever happens on Sunday and Monday in 5 years, 10 years, certainly the euro will look very different as a currency. Do you agree with that? Do you think it will be, by definition, necessarily different in terms of its makeup, in terms of how it functions?
It depends on whether the European Union institutions have learnt their lesson. They are currently starting to negotiate for Bulgaria to join the eurozone. Now, if you're negotiating on that respect with a country that clearly doesn't meet the criteria until now, it means you haven't learned much. It also, European Union wishes to enlarge and wishes to bring in Kosovo, Albania, the Republic of Macedonia, Serbia. These are problematic countries, and therefore, if you're negotiating to bring them in the European Union in the belief that being a member will sort out their problems, well, then you really haven't learned your lessons from Greece. It depends what the European Union has learned from these lessons.
It sounds like maybe we should be anticipating more of a two or three or four tier system of membership then, where the currency union maybe shifts slightly away from being at the very heart.
In fact, before the European Union enlarged into the Eastern Europe, they called this a Europe of concentric circles. And that was a project. So you have the centre of the circle, which is the key members, as was then. Then you have an outer circle of countries attached, and then an outer circle of countries which are more loosely associated. There is now a two-tier system, the Eurozone and the non-Eurozone. There's another tier system, the northern countries and the southern countries. You have the associate members. A variable geometry, so to speak, is there, but it hasn't been crystallised into a Europe of either concentric circles or tier Europe. And that does seem like a very plausible step ahead for Europe.
Constantine Buhaya there, chatting with Tom Edwards on Friday's edition of The Briefing. This is the recap on Monocle 24, and time now for a highlight from The Globalist. Well, the UK is just one of many countries throughout Europe and the world in the midst of controversy about migrants, mainly from war-torn Middle Eastern and African countries desperately trying to gain entry to safer places. But one nation has the opposite problem. So hungry are officials in Budapest to get emigrants back, they're offering not insubstantial cash incentives to entice people home. But why? Adam Labor is Monocle's correspondent in Budapest, and he spoke to Peter Cardwell on Friday's edition of The Globalist.
The reasons for it are that there's a massive emigration of young and educated people out of Hungary. The figures aren't precise, but the estimates vary between up to 500,000 or 800,000. And it's clear, especially if you go to places like London, the place is just full of young Hungarians. And the problem is that many of these are the more entrepreneurial, more forward-looking ones, you know, because you need a bit of courage and talent to set up a new life in a new country. There's been a survey recently that said 30% of them have college degrees, and that's 200,000 college graduates, which a country of 10 million people can ill afford to lose.
Doesn't it smack slightly of desperation to try to bribe people with financial incentives to come back to the country?
Yes, it certainly does. Although the government would say that it's not desperation, it's just facing the economic reality. I mean, the government minister has admitted that Hungary cannot compete with the kind of salaries that you're getting. We all know that if you go to London, you can earn much more than that. Although, of course, the cost of living in London is exponentially higher. I don't think it's going to make much difference because people who've left, they don't leave to come back for 100,000 foreign forints a month, which is like around 330 euros. That's not what's going to make the difference. They leave, I mean, partly because young and educated people have always left. They've always sought adventures. But now we're living in a world which other generations didn't have. People in Eastern Europe and Central Europe can simply just decamp to London, set up there, start a new life. There's no paperwork. There's no problems with visas or immigration or health. It's all because they're in the European Union. So they're thinking, why wouldn't they take this opportunity?
So what about the uptake in this scheme and what are the practicalities of it? How much money are they offering?
I believe it's about 100,000 forints a month, which is about 300, 320 euros, something like that.
But that represents quite a lot. I mean, you could certainly rent a one-bedroom apartment for that in Budapest, presumably?
Just about, yeah. You could. Probably could with and cover the bills on that, depending on where you wanted to live. You could just about do that. And then if you've got your salary on top, obviously that makes a difference. If you're earning 200,000 a month, an extra 100,000 does make a difference. But the uptake is quite small. I mean, it's hard to find out exactly what it is, but then we're talking of a few hundred people have registered on the website.
Monocle's correspondent in Budapest there, Adam Labor, in conversation with Peter Cardwell on The Globalist. Still to come on today's show, we'll discuss the aftermath facing Tunisia after that devastating terrorist attack. And we'll ask whether the age of 24-hour news has really made us more informed. I'm Ben Rylan, and this is The Recap.
As Monocle's editors and correspondents dart from city to city, they get to know the best places to rest their heads, stretch their limbs after a long flight, and kick back with a contact in a hard-to-find cocktail bar. All this information is now available in a new collection of books, Monocle's Travel Guide series published by Gestalten. Up first, London.
This place won't ever beg for your adoration. It's just not that kind of town. But if you stick around long enough and occasionally give it your undivided attention, the city will eventually reveal what all the fuss is about. Trust us, it's worth the wait.
To celebrate the publication of our London Guide, Monocle Films has produced a cinematic portrait of the city, from wild parks and lofty gardens to culinary discoveries and the best music venues. Our film journeys to our favourite places in the city we call home. London, premiering now in the film section at monocle.com.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted right here on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Now looking at Tunisia. The mass shooting on a beach in the resort town of Sousse has been blamed on an Islamic State-inspired militant, and the death toll of 38 includes over 30 Britons. It's raised questions about the safety of people travelling abroad under a climate of anti-Western feeling coming from the Middle East. And it's also got many wondering about Tunisia's future, a country that has shown real progress since the Arab Spring in establishing a free and democratic society. On Monday's edition of Midori House, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck was joined by the foreign affairs specialist from the Times of London, Michael Binion, and Alessio Patilano, a lecturer in war studies at King's College.
Tunisia was barely bouncing back from the early spring attack in the museum, and all the data were suggesting that they were sort of barely coming back in terms of tourism. The fact that it happens now at the beginning of the summer season, I think this second time, it really is giving a terrible blow to the tourist industry, because it does raise a question as to the abilities of Tunisian government and authorities in a broader sense to actually monitor and control their own territory. And it's the fact that this is happening on the back of something else. It's not the one-off. It's like, oh my God, this has happened. No, it has already happened. And it hasn't happened 10 years ago. It happened 3 months ago. So that sort of really raises some very important questions.
Michael, a couple of points here. You know, one, there's nothing stopping somebody coming with a gun down to one of those beaches. And we know that there are thousands and thousands of illegal migrants, some of whom may be fleeing from the fighting, some of whom may not have been on the nicest side in the fighting or coming into Europe. So we don't know who is in Southern Europe. We can't police all of those beaches. In a way, it could happen anywhere, couldn't it?
It could. And indeed, it isn't necessarily on a beach, as we've seen in France, where some disgruntled employee decapitated his employer. And that kind of atrocity, a freelance lone wolf kind of atrocity, could happen anywhere at any time. And this is the biggest problem. I think tourism is pretty well almost dead in the entire Arab world by now. Egypt is struggling. And I have to say, for Egypt, it's even more important because their tourist industry is larger. It's more important to them. There are many more of them, and they need the money desperately. They are making bigger efforts, I have to say, to protect their tourist sites. One of the scandals is that Tunisia didn't bring in armed police patrols in the tourist resorts earlier. They should have thought about that. Mm. They had plenty of warning. They've actually got the largest number of people joining IS from any Arab country. So I have to blame the authorities for not doing more to anticipate this. What they can do after it's happened is really questionable.
As a bigger question, with the radicalization of a younger generation, what's, I think, more concerning, and I wonder what you make of this, Michael, is here's a gentleman who was, we've seen the videos, he went from breakdancing, happy-go-lucky kid to being a killer. Around these people, it seems to be a whole group of people who are not going to go and do that, but kind of have some sympathy with it, or kind of feel that Muslims and the Christians in the end can't get along, that they, you know, they have some empathy for the idea of a caliphate. And that's a generational shift that's worryingly kind of getting embedded. Do you think that we're fighting in a way the wrong battles? This guy is a terrorist and a terrible person, but there's an emotional hearts and minds battle that is being lost every single day.
That is absolutely the key to all of it. And I think the key to all of it must be that the Muslim world itself has to get to grips with this phenomenon. One of the sad and disappointing things is that we have not had a really rigorous, loud, forceful denunciation from senior Muslim leaders in Muslim countries. We've had people saying, oh, this is not Islam, Islam is a peaceful religion, things of this kind. Where is the Sheikh of Al-Azhar University standing up to say this is barbarism? Where is the Grand Sheikh in Saudi Arabia saying this kind of belief is nothing to do with our country or our religion? We haven't heard it. And as long as we're not hearing it, we are not getting a confrontation with a mentality that is feeding on this generational dissatisfaction and this social malaise that's all around. And it is the Muslim leaders themselves who need to take the lead.
That's certainly true, but perhaps also we need to reflect upon the fact that most of these young lads, they have lots of other problems that have very little to do with religion itself. I'm not sure if many of them heard the voice, an authoritative voice saying, like, this is barbarism, it would allow them to address the problem. It's also very personal. Many of them are very isolated. They have some sort of difficulty in the society and the community they're part of. So that's perhaps where one should start sort of working as well.
Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck there in conversation with Alessio Patilano and Michael Binion in a highlight from our daily discussion program, Midori House. This is the recap on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Time now for another look at our series on The Globalist this week, focusing on the changing role of the television news anchor. The arrival of the 24-hour news network in the 1980s drew cynicism from many in the news world. How could they possibly fill a round-the-clock schedule? But as the Gulf War took hold, Americans began to see the power in CNN's ability to cover the unfolding crisis with depth and detail. Today, the 24-hour news network is a hallmark of soft diplomacy around the world. But what effect has the rolling cycle of information had on the traditional nightly bulletin? In this highlight, Ivor Gaber, professor of journalism at Sussex University, offers an insight into the many facets of the cable news anchor and why the nightly bulletin still matters.
The emergence of 24-hour news outlets, which now goes back probably 30 years, has had a significant impact on the media. Basically, people no longer had to wait for a fixed point, whether that's their morning newspaper or the flagship news program, to find out what was happening. Perhaps the turning point was 9/11, when word went round before the days of social media that something big was happening and people could switch on live coverage of the terrible events in New York, coming from CNN and then from the mainstream broadcasters as they realised this was a big story. So we've seen a major transformation in the nature of news from being, let's put it, a dinner appointment where you waited for dinner to be served, sat down and ate it in the order it was given to you, as opposed to a sort of pick and mix supermarket where you nipped in when it suited you and selected really what you wanted to see. When people designed 24-hour news, they didn't expect people to sit down for more than 15 minutes at a time. So it's snacking as opposed to a major meal. There are two sorts of news presenters on cable news now, on 24-hour news now. And I'm not sure audiences make the distinction, but I certainly do and others do. There is the presenter who these days is almost invariably a journalist. Not necessarily a glamorous journalist, but certainly a journalist, because in their role of 24-hour news, they have to do far more live journalism than the people presenting the fixed point news. However, there is a second sort of presenter, particularly, I suppose, embodied by Fox News, somebody like Bill O'Reilly, the controversialist, the presenter with a point of view who isn't really, for my money, a news presenter, but is there giving the news prior to him bashing up or lauding one of his guests. So we've got two sorts of presenters. The mainstream, if you like, are the journalists who are there not just to read the news, but to react on screen live. And then there are the controversialists, the opinionated, there to attract audiences, as certainly people like O'Reilly do. Ratings depended on how the audiences related to their anchors. Usually they were men, mature men, and their notion was, here is the news you can trust. And the trust was the big issue. And the trust revolved around the personality of the newsreader. And there were legendary newsreaders. Even today, the news anchors on the main three networks in the US get huge salaries and are much sought after. However, I think the trust of the network of the 24-hour news service is much less dependent upon the news anchor. I mean, for a start, with the nightly news, you had one anchor. Maybe he did 4 days, 5 days a week. It was usually a he. With 24-hour news, by definition, you've got many anchors. It's impossible, really. Audiences tend not to have what we call an appointment to view with a 24-hour channel. They'll switch it on and they probably won't even remember who the anchor is unless he or she is particularly bad. The traditional bulletins are important in one way, that they are flagships of authority, if you like, credibility. They say to their audiences, we are a national and international broadcaster and you can trust us. But audiences have declined significantly. The BBC 10 o'clock, which is the top rating programme in the UK, now gets audiences of 4 or 5 million, ITV 2 or 3 million. It wasn't that long ago when they both shows were in double figures. In the UK, the main two terrestrial channels, BBC and ITV, build their schedules around their two main news bulletins, around 6 and around 10. And for audiences, it gives them recognisable landmarks. After 6 is the start of the evening's viewing, if you like. After the 10 o'clock news at 10:30, maybe we start thinking about bed. So audiences like familiarity, and that's why they're important.
Ivor Gaber there, taking a look at the complexities of being a news anchor in the age of the 24-hour rolling cycle. This is the recap on Monocle 24. Before we head off, just enough time to take a quick dash over to beautiful northern Italy. Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé was busy leafing through some of the press in the lovely town of Murano this week. In this snippet from the briefing, Tyler starts off by discussing the massive influx of Italian tourists set to take hold of the quaint village.
Who needs to be a Boy Scout when you can be a junior volunteer firefighter? In our current issue, we have a story about just the wonderful fire departments that you see going into every town in and around South Tyrol, really remarkably stunning architecturally. Most of them made up of volunteer firefighters. What's interesting is there's a junior league of 3,000, and they just had their local version of their Olympics, where every little village gets together and tries to, of course, climb ladders and jump through windows. But it's quite interesting because, you know, it's amazing to see this type of sort of community youth spirit at a time when, of course, everyone bemoans Generation Y and beyond.
Monocle's Tyler Brulé there, chatting with our own Marcus Hippie. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of The Recap, thanks to our editor Weidong Lin. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Ben Ryland, thank you for listening and enjoy your weekend.